Welcome to the program. I'm Jeff Scheckman. Another season of baseball is underway. Like the changes of the seasons, it's a recurring rite of passage that somehow reminds us that the world's still spinning on its axis. But even in baseball, there are moments when it seems to be spinning out of control. Moments that change the game and our view of it, like Curt Flood's challenge to the reserve clause in 1972 and the rise and fall of Pete Rose. Rose remains one of baseball's most iconic and controversial figures. Today, through the lens of my guest, best-selling author Keith O'Brien, and his latest book, Charlie Hustle, we explore a captivating chronicle that is not just a baseball biography, but a profound cultural history of America in the later half of the 20th century. With a record number of hits that still stands unchallenged, Rose embodied the American dream, a working-class kid from Cincinnati who rose to the pinnacle of baseball glory. Yet this very glory was marred by one of the biggest scandals in baseball history. In the 1980s, Rose found himself at the center of a storm that would not only change his life, but also the very fabric of the game of baseball. His involvement in gambling, his association with unsavory characters, and the subsequent lies that came to light led to a dramatic fall from grace. Keith O'Brien explores the complexities of Rose's character, and his narrative goes beyond the surface, revealing a man who, while unyielding, became a symbol of changing America and its beloved pastime. Keith O'Brien is the New York Times best-selling author of Paradise Falls, Fly Girls, and Outside Shot. He was a finalist for the Penn ESPN Award for Literary Sports Writing and an award-winning journalist. He's written for numerous publications, and his stories have appeared on NPR and This American Life. And it is my pleasure to welcome Keith O'Brien here to talk about Charlie Hustle, the rise and fall of Pete Rose in the last glory days of baseball. Keith, thanks so much for joining us.
Jeff, thanks for having me.
Well, it is a delight to have you here. 40 years later, we're still talking about Pete Rose. Why is that?
Yeah, we can't get past it, can we? I mean, I think there's a couple of reasons why he's still relevant all these many decades later. The first is, you know, we have forgotten, frankly, how beloved Pete Rose once was. You know, in the last 35 years, as Pete has told his lies about his gambling, then come to some kind of turnaround on those lies and really become a caricature of himself along the way, we've forgotten that he was one of our great icons in the 20th century. You know, he was in professional baseball for 30 seasons, Jeff, 1960 to 1989. And, you know, when he was there, you know, the game changed and he was often at the center of the biggest stories of the time. So he was iconic. He was beloved. And I think the other reason why we can't get past this story is that we just never fully reckoned with it. You know, when he was banned in 1989, from the game for life, a banishment that he agreed to, by the way, he was still going to be eligible to appear on Hall of Fame ballots 2 years later in 1991. That would have been 5 years after his last at bat as a player. But in the intervening time between his banishment and 1991, the rules changed at the Hall of Fame. Specifically, the board at the Hall of Fame changed the rules and made it so that ineligible players like Pete could not appear on the ballot. And so, you know, because of that rule change, which was really intended just to remove Rose from the ballot, we never really had a chance to reckon with it, to discuss it, to vote on it. And I think for all of those reasons, it has just sort of lingered like a cloud over the sport and really over our culture.
There's also something in Rose and what he did and the way it played out that struck a kind of fear, it seems, in the heart of baseball. Talk about that.
Well, I mean, I think the big fear that baseball had and that the Hall of Fame had in relation to Pete Rose was the fact that he was still lying about what had happened. You know, Pete played with this ferocity and tenacity on the field. He played more like a football fullback or safety than he did a utility, second baseman, which is what he was. This attitude on the field, is one of the things that helped make him iconic. Pete would go on to set the all-time hit record in baseball, and is still all these many years later, just one of two men, only two, who have ever compiled more than 4,000 hits in the game. But it wasn't even the hits that mattered. I mean, people gravitated to him. The press gravitated to him because of how hard he played on the field, because of the way he, quote, hustled. But that same hustle, that same tenacity, that same ferocity, that same unwillingness to bend, unwillingness to be vulnerable, are many of the same qualities that almost doomed him to failure as a person, and doomed him to failure in particular with his problems with gambling and gambling on baseball. Pete couldn't be honest for so long about what had happened that baseball and the Hall of Fame didn't want him, understandably, going to Cooperstown and being enshrined while he was still essentially lying about his greatest sins.
There was also a sense that he became, or at least the sense of some in baseball was, that he became bigger than the game itself. And that made a lot of people nervous.
Well, like a lot of iconic stars, he was central to the game in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. He was named, in fact, the player of the decade of the 1970s by the Sporting News, which was, the Bible of baseball in those days. So in a great many ways, he was, if not bigger than the game, he was the game. He represented what the game was. He represented in the minds of the press, the best of the game, and of course that was threatening for the sport at a time when the sport was banishing him for his sins against the game.
Talk about his efforts to try and redeem himself after he finally was honest about some of this.
Yeah, it's been a halting course over the past 35 years. And that was one reason why I wanted to do the book. I wanted to really reckon with this story one last time while the principals, including Pete Rose, were still alive. And I wanted to do it in a granular way on a human level. Because in the end, I think that's what this is. This is a human story. And I wanted to capture that humanity and the tragedy of that story. But the fact is, Pete's banned in 1989, and he's banned for betting on baseball, betting on his own team, the Cincinnati Reds, to win, which was in violation of Major League Baseball rules. Pete Rose knew that. He still placed the wagers anyway. But then he did lie about it for 15 years. For 15 years into the 2000s, he continued to say that he did not bet on baseball. And this wasn't just something that he said in public, in interviews. His closest friends, his inner circle actually believed it too. And so it's only in 2004 that he finally does come clean. And it admits that he had bet on baseball and on the Reds. And he does it in a way that is perceived to be craven. He does it in a memoir that he sells and it receives a large book advance to write. And, he gets a lot of criticism for that. And I guess from my perspective, I don't really begrudge him that. I think what's most problematic about the memoir is it's pretty thin on the details. It's pretty thin on the darkness that propelled him to make these choices. And he doesn't really, truly, fully reckon with what he did. And so, you know, with this book, I wanted to go back and try to push him to reckon with that darkness.
Talk about that darkness and the world that he inhabited at that point in time.
Pete had been a gambler for a long time. He was born and raised on the west side of Cincinnati, a predominantly white working class part of town. And gambling was pretty common in his neighborhood, in his family. His father, Big Pete, loved his son, Pete Rose, loved watching him play baseball, loved pushing him hard to be the best he could be. But Big Pete also loved going to the horse track in Cincinnati. And some of Little Pete's fondest memories of his childhood aren't about playing baseball. It was going to the track with his dad and standing on the rail there at the finish line and rooting for his daddy's horse to win. And, you know, one of the first thing that Pete does after he gets called up with the big club, the Cincinnati Reds in 1963, and has some fraction of money, though not much, Pete starts to go to the racetrack too. And, you know, he becomes almost a fixture at this racetrack in Cincinnati, often sometimes right before games. He would, you know, go in the afternoon, hang out, play some bets, and go down to the ballpark, hit the batting cage, play the game. But sometime in the early 1970s, based on my research and reporting, which is new here, Pete does begin to bet with bookies on the west side of Cincinnati. He begins to place bets on a regular basis with a man named Alphonse Esselman. And Alphonse Esselman, you know, liked to present himself as a local mover and shaker. He was a member of the Western Hills Country Club. He drove nice cars. He bought fine furs for his wife. But really, what was financing a lot of those purchases and his dues at the country club were the gambling schemes and bookmaking operations that Alphonse Esselman ran in Cincinnati for years. And Pete begins to place bets with Alphonse Esselman in the early 1970s, but quickly graduates to using other bookies, some on the fringes of the mob. And by the 1980s, it's clear to people around him that he has a gambling problem.
He was also spending a lot of money on flashy things.
Well, sure. Yeah, absolutely. Pete, again, was raised in a working class part of Cincinnati, did not come from money. His house, his childhood home, was just almost a stone's throw from the banks of the Ohio River. Several miles outside of downtown Cincinnati, in the years when he was growing up, it was almost crumbling into the river. It's even more so today. He did not come from money, and he did attach a certain amount of worth to having money, and liked to show people that he was someone. With the purchases he made, in particular cars. You know, Pete Rose loved buying the newest, flashiest car, whether it was the first car he ever purchased, which was a lime green Corvette back when he was in the minor leagues, to a brown, you know, convertible Pontiac Grand Prix when he was a rookie, or to the red Porsches he would have later. Yeah, these things were status symbols for him. And it's sort of crazy to think that someone of Pete's iconic stature would need to have symbols, but he did.
And yet, when you think about this, it's so strange, because context is so important, that if you think about it in today's frame of mind, that had he come clean, had he admitted the truth right away, you know, gone into a 12-step program or done something like that, he would have been a very different outcome for him.
Well, right, and that's part of the tragedy of this story. I really do you know, think this is far more than just a baseball book. You know, when I set out to write Charlie Hustle, I actually didn't think about it as a baseball book at all. I really see this as a Greek tragedy that just happened to play out in and around an American baseball field. And again, you know, my reporting shows that you're right, Jeff. If Pete had come clean in 1989, everything's different. You know, at the time, Pete Rose was the manager of the Cincinnati Reds. He was still one of baseball's greatest icons. And Major League Baseball gets a tip that Sports Illustrated is investigating a rumor that Pete has bet on baseball and that Pete has bet on the Reds. And, you know, this is February 1989. It's just before spring's training is about to begin. And so the men in charge decide to call Pete to New York for a secret meeting. And this was a meeting that was attended by the outgoing commissioner of baseball, Peter Uberoth, the incoming commissioner of baseball, and the current National League president, Bart Giamatti, and Bart Giamatti's good friend and confidant, Faye Vincent, the new deputy commissioner. And, you know, at this meeting, you know, Uberoth and Giamatti and Vincent ask him, Pete Rose, a simple question, you know, have you bet on baseball? And Pete denies it, almost a knee-jerk denial that, by the way, based on the interviews I did with people who were in the room, it was believable. They believed him. But they also knew that they could have sit around and take Pete's word for it when Sports Illustrated was conducting its own investigation for a potential story. And so, you know, Pete leaves and they ultimately decide to hire a man who was widely overqualified, and I say that with respect, a former Department of Justice lawyer by the name of John Dowd. And they want John Dowd to investigate this rumor. And this is where it all begins to unravel for Pete. And what's sad is, you know, if Pete is honest in the room that day, if he doesn't lie, if he tells Uberoth and Giamatti and Vincent that, yes, he has bet on baseball, and yes, he has bet on the Reds, and yes, he has a problem, my reporting shows that baseball would have done anything it possibly could to help Pete Rose, to save him, really. And I don't mean to suggest that that doesn't mean that Pete wouldn't have faced some kind of punishment. I believe he would have. But I don't believe it would have been the kind of punishment that we are still reckoning with 35 years later.
What were the concerns that Giamatti and Vincent and company, what did they think would happen, if anything, vis-a-vis baseball, if this came out, or if in fact it turned out to be true, even with Rose lying? What were their initial feelings about that?
Bart Giamatti, again, the National League president at the time and the man who was just a couple weeks away from becoming the commissioner, was probably the smartest commissioner, most intelligent commissioner baseball was ever going to have. He had long served at Yale as a professor of Renaissance literature. He was the former president of Yale. And Bart was deeply against gambling in all its formats. As Giamatti would say later that summer, you know, anyone who places a wager on themselves, even if it's to win, has compromised the game because they have put their personal interests over the interests of the team. And of course, there was a much darker layer to this as well. Because anyone who's placing bets on the game has now, you know, potentially put themselves in a conflict of interest with the bookies who at the time were taking these illegal bets. And so there was a reason why it had been long against the rules of baseball to consort with gamblers, to hang out with bookies, much less, you know, place bets with bookies. It was potentially destructive to the game then. It's still destructive to the game now. And so for all of those reasons, you know, Major League Baseball knew that these potential allegations involving Pete Rose were explosive. It was like a hand grenade sitting there on the boardroom table in the office next to Peter Ueberoff's desk.
When this came out, talk about the public response.
Well, it quickly divided. And I think that's important because we're still wrestling with that divide today. Because Pete didn't tell the truth, because he was so convincing in telling folks that baseball had it wrong, there was a large portion of the population and of baseball fans who believed Pete. They believed that, yeah, maybe he bets on the dogs and the horses and some football games, but there's no way he bet on the Reds. And then, you know, there was a different cohort of fans who looked at the evidence, which was voluminous. I mean, in a matter of 8 weeks, John Dowd, the newly hired special counsel for Major League Baseball, and his small team of investigators, which included, you know, former FBI agents, built a dossier on Pete Rose that is thousands of pages long, that as a first draft of history is stunningly accurate and on the mark. They had him. They had his bank records. They had his phone records. They had interviews and depositions with people who had placed Pete's bets on baseball with a bookie who had received those bets. I mean, they had him, you know, absolutely dead to rights.
And yet, to this day, there are people that still defend Rose.
Well, I think the defense today is different. You know, we're living now in a different time. You know, since 2018 and the Supreme Court decision that effectively overturned a federal law that had limited legalized sports gambling to one place, Nevada. Sports gambling is now everywhere, Jeff.
Everywhere.
I mean, as you know.
Everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, 38 states it's legal. In most places, you can do it on your phone. You can place bets from your couch or from the cheap seats at the stadium. And you know, Major League Baseball and every other league has done an about face and is 100% in on the new gambling craze. And for one reason, because it's profitable. And for a second reason, because any league who would have resisted at this point would become instantly irrelevant. Americans want to gamble on sports. I mean, last year, we gambled legally $120 billion on sports. And this is a new record, by the way, that shattered the previous year's record by about $30 billion. And just to put this money in perspective, because it is sort of wild, funny money, if we had taken that $120 billion that we bet legally on sports last year and instead pooled our money, we could have purchased every single Major League Baseball team and then still had about $40 billion hanging around to do other things. I mean, it's an absurd amount of money. And so the world has changed. The culture has changed. Sports have changed. Our laws on gambling have changed. And it's, you know, impossible not to see the story of Pete Rose in a different light, given all of that.
Except that I think that the public sentiment, and I may be totally wrong about this, but the public sentiment towards players gambling on their own games or in their own league is still pretty negative, as much as everybody has embraced sports gambling.
Well, it's negative, absolutely, for all the reasons that I mentioned before. And yeah, I want to be clear. Just because the world has changed, the rule hasn't changed. Rule 21D, which says that a player cannot bet on games that he or she is involved in, that remains in place, again, for all the obvious reasons. And so that's true. But we've also had, at this point, a number of players, college, NFL players, be caught, you know, gambling in some way. And the punishment is not banishment for life. It's often a very light punishment. And so given these changes, at a minimum, it felt like a great time to revisit the story of one of our most notorious gamblers, because the fact is, you know, Pete Rose is just as relevant today as he was 50 years ago, if not more so, because of how the world has changed.
How did it change the game, if at all? How did it change baseball and the way people saw baseball after this?
I really see Pete Rose as a fault line. You know, up until that point, there was a tendency to celebrate our sports heroes, in baseball or otherwise, as perfect, pure heroes. And I think if you look at 1989 as a fault line, and you look at the fall of Pete Rose in August of that year, and look at everything that comes next, it's just a different world. You know, it's almost like that moment and that scandal divides the era of the heroes from the era of the cheaters. You know, and I think you can tie a direct line from 1989 and Pete's banishment to many of the changes that have happened in baseball since that time. You know, that summer when baseball was investigating Pete Rose for his gambling, as they should have, players were already injecting themselves with steroids in the locker rooms of Major League Baseball, and in particular in the locker room in Oakland, California, where Jose Canseco was already doing steroids. Mark McGwire was already doing it or about to start. And the steroid era that was coming would envelop the game and tarnish it in its own way. Players, you know, whether they were using performance-enhancing drugs or not, started to swing their bats differently, hoping to get the big contracts that the steroid users were getting. That changed batting averages in the league, slowed the game down. There were fewer hits, more strikeouts. Fan interest waned to the point that, you know, just last year, you know, Major League Baseball had to change many rules just to bring some speed and movement back into the game. And I just think all of this really can be traced back to 1989 and the stunning scandal involving Pete Rose.
Did Rose get some slack cut because of his loyalty to the Reds? The era of free agency, which turned off a lot of people to the sport, I think it's fair to say, and Rose's loyalty to the Reds all those years, did that work in his favor?
Well, ultimately, no. I mean, because, you know, he was criticized too for chasing money. I mean, Pete Rose leaves the Reds in 1978 for one of those early big multi-year contracts. It sounds small, of course, when we talk about it today, but Pete leaves the Reds at the end of the 1978 season to go to Philadelphia for a four-year contract worth about $3.8 million. So, you know, he was also, you know, lumped into that that free agent pool, and you know, there were fans in Cincinnati who wished he had never left. And so, no, I don't think Pete got any slack for his loyalty to the Reds, you know. But I will say, again, based on my reporting, officials at Major League Baseball were aware of Pete's gambling problems. Not that he was betting on baseball, but his deep and persistent gambling problems. A full decade earlier, right about the time when he signs that contract to go to Philadelphia, Major League Baseball officials pay him a visit in Cincinnati to discuss his debts with bookies. They're worried about it. And that is something that he does get slack for, because despite these clear concerns that at least some people in Major League Baseball have at that time, there is no news stories about Pete Rose and bookies and Pete Rose and gambling debts. This meeting makes absolutely no headlines whatsoever.
Did the Pete Rose story at least have a chilling impact on other players maybe not doing the same thing?
Absolutely. I don't believe that Pete was the only player using a bookie in the 1970s and 80s. I mean, again, we're living in a different time now where that seems crazy. But if you wanted to place a bet on an NCAA basketball game during March or the Super Bowl or the NFL playoffs, you either had to go to Nevada in the 1970s and 80s or you had to know a bookie. And a lot of people did have bookies. And so I do think Pete's fall scared a lot of players away from these kind of activities. And I think more important than that, I just think it's a universal human tale, Jeff. This was a man who had it all, who came from an ordinary background to claim it all. And then, you know, in large part because of his own decisions, he loses it all. And that is just a cautionary tale for anybody, not just players.
And finally, Keith, what do you think that Rose thinks of the world of sports gambling today, where it is, as you've talked about, so prevalent and so pervasive everywhere?
Well, it's affected Rose in two ways. I mean, one, you know, he is very cognizant of the cosmic ironies here, a league that pursued him for his gambling is now, you know, frankly, encouraging fans to gamble on the games and sometimes, running advertisements for gambling platforms in the moment on television, telling viewers what a current player's chances are of hitting a home run in that very moment. I mean, there are some cosmic ironies there and it upsets Pete. But I will say, in other ways, Pete has benefited from the changes. You know, in recent years, since the legalization of gambling in America, he has appeared on gambling podcasts. He, Jimmy the Greek, the old odds maker, once did in the 1970s. Pete Rose has, given out his own tips for games and what to wager on. And he has in the last couple of years been hired at times to be the show at the opening of a new casino or a new sports book. He's been hired specifically to come twice to Cincinnati, his hometown, to place the very first bet on a blackjack table at a casino in downtown Cincinnati. And then just a short time after that, returned to that casino to place a first bet at the sports book in Cincinnati, Ohio. So nothing really captures how the world has changed more than that.
Keith O'Brien, the book is Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose in the Last Glory Days of Baseball. Keith, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
Thank you.